This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. School districts are still struggling to understand what the governor's amendatory veto of the school funding formula last week means for them. But Unit 5 Superintendent Mark Daniel says it's not great.
We saw it up and now it's gone, that spreadsheet. We're really unsure of what it is.
And school districts still have no idea when they'll be getting state payments, however much those might be. Plus, will school buses run on time in Unit 5? And an update on the opioid crisis in McLean County. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. School districts are still struggling to understand what the governor's mandatory veto of the school funding formula means to them. This is in the form of a back-of-the-envelope calculation called spreadsheets, which came out Monday. We talk with Unit 5 Superintendent Mark Daniel, who says the spreadsheets show the governor has taken away after the legislature gave.
We saw it up, and now it's gone, that spreadsheet. We're seeing one version now that it may be approximately $200,000 in our favor. Originally, the Senate Bill 1 was about $400,000, and Berrickman's bill, Senate Bill 1124, was about $800,000 towards our favor. We're really unsure of what it is, to be honest. We've tried to look at the various components of the formula, and as a matter of fact, several superintendents are getting together to write a response and to send it to our local politicians as well. Where do our superintendents stand for?
What are you going to say?
And we're going to say some key pieces, which are part of the amendatory veto. I don't think there's any public school superintendent that's going to agree with the scholarship program that has been, that's part of the nine pieces. The veto, i.e. scholarships, to me is a voucher system. That money flowing into private and parochial schools. I will never agree with that. I think money should stay within the public sector because it's public dollars.
State Senator Andy Menar said that this is a manipulation of the law to divest the state from public education over time. You agree with that statement?
I strongly agree with that statement. I'll tell you why. Having been in the state of Indiana and also in the state of Michigan, I can tell you my friends who are superintendents in public schools, and I have friends who are also in non-public schools. My non-public school colleagues can't build fast enough. And when you're in the right community where there are choices for parents, they will make those choices perhaps because they perceive that to be best for their child, when in actually, in my opinion, it's overall hurting the public school system. When those families begin to migrate out of public schools, then we have what I would project as the haves and have-nots, which to me, I'll take it a step further, it's the beginning of segregation.
What happens to a society in which there is a two-tiered or segregated education system?
And I think we saw that all the way through the mid-60s. You have some institutions that have more resources, more supplies, and so forth. I thought that was exactly the opposite of what we're trying to do with the evidence-based model. It was about equity. It's about equality. That is very important. When you become a segregated institution, you truly do have those who have more resources versus those who don't.
The governor also made a change in the way adequacy is measured for school districts under the formula by saying that TIF districts don't matter, that school districts will have the amount that they can support education toward adequacy figured on the total value of property in the district rather than the total that's taxable absent the TIF district, the Economic Development District totals? How much would that impact Unit 5?
Well, again, if I look at the previous numbers, I think that's where our calculation goes to, from roughly 400,000 down to approximately 200,000. So it's not a major impact for Unit 5, but it could potentially be, i.e., we have some TIF companies that are receiving TIF. Overall, though, if you look at other districts, it may be a major impact, which, again, we're supposed to be held harmless, same amount of funding. Is it truly going to be? And what's the timeline on that? I'm going to tell you, this is what happens when you wait to the last minute and you try to create a bargain in a short amount of time, which really is under extreme pressure and, I think, chaos. Therefore, these things slide in or part of a proposal, which I don't know whether that's we're here bargaining and
bargaining
this is
in public.
Bargaining in public, and that's where we are. And I'm going to try to do bargain something that truly I know that's not going to exist, but it's part of a bargaining strategy. And quite frankly, let's get this done and let's do it to the true, I would call it the true purpose of what the evidence-based model was founded on.
There is also a cut in dollars for schools with declining enrollments, even apart from adequacy. Under the original model in SB 1, adequacy was supposed to protect school districts that had declining enrollments if they did not already have adequate funding. Now they get cut if enrollments fall, no matter whether they are inadequate or not.
And my understanding on that piece, and I'm going to, I think you're trying, the purpose is try to be as fair as you possibly can in this agreement. And part of that would be, if you give a district enough time to acclimate to this particular piece of the formula, which, again, we're going to be funded based on number of students. If there is a tremendous decrease in number of students, then yes, I would, if you give me enough years, and I would say at least 3 years, to be able to adjust, I can adjust accordingly. But if you try to tell me to do that immediately, that would be very difficult because 100 students don't make truly a difference in regards to teacher allocation, in regards to staff members that are needed, in regards to transportation, which is another cost, and so on and so forth. But if I can adjust for 100 and then 100 and then 100, now I can perhaps reduce some sections, reduce some buses, but it has to be something giving me time to do so. So my caveat there would be then, yes, I think per pupil is fair, but give us time to have to adjust. Because again, if I'm having 1,000 students gone, which of course that's not happening, but 1,000 students, then I should be reducing my staffing. I don't need quite as number of teachers, and maybe I need to be looking at even what buildings are open or not open. But again, I'm just giving you some scenarios. So overall, I would say per pupil, we could agree to that, but give us time.
So maybe somewhere between the original bill and what the governor amended the bill to be. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Unit 5 Superintendent Mark Daniel. You've been critical of several of the governor's amendments to SB 1. Is there anything that you agree with that he's done to it?
Well, I have to say, he's tried to hold true to the majority of the evidence-based model, i.e. the 27 elements of best practices. Now, and I have to say this as well, he has supported public education in regards to the funding. Last year, 100% for GSA. And yes, we all know It was not 100% in regards to our categorical. So I'm still looking at third quarter and fourth quarter payments for transportation special ed services of the tune to $5.4 million. Now, the governor said money's been allocated. It's there. It should be given to you. But the comptroller's the issue. And then you talk to the comptroller, and the comptroller will point the finger the other way. The point being is, I do appreciate his finding ways to increase the funding for public education. So we're not prorated any longer. Feather in his cap, I truly appreciate that. I appreciate that the fact that we truly have an evidence-based model formula presented and has moved to the point where it's near implementation. That I would not have thought we had had 2 years ago. So those are the primary pieces that I look at as Governor Rauner has been very successful.
You are due your first state aid payment, what, Friday?
Correct.
Any signs that it's actually going to arrive?
It will not arrive. I see probably even 3 weeks to 4 weeks out. So we're trying to be realistic about this. That's why you do have reserves, but you can only go for so long. So this needs to be settled, and it needs to be settled within the month.
Mark Daniel is the Unit 5 superintendent. School starts on August 16th. Open registration is happening now for new students in the Twin Cities. Will Unit 5's bus system be ready to go on the first day of school next week? That's the big question on tonight's school board agenda. Unit 5's transportation officials will tell board members what they've done to prevent a repeat of last year's rocky start when route changes, driver shortages, and poor communication led to upset parents and safety concerns. GLT's Ryan Denham reports the district's transportation vendor First Student may be on a short leash.
Unit 5 transports 10,000, or 73%, of its students to school every day. Its fleet of buses travel 14,000 route miles every day, a massive undertaking that's been outsourced to First Student since 2013. First Student is now in the last year of its contract, meaning another bad year could lead Unit 5 to make a change for 2018-19. School board member Joe Cleary, also a Unit 5 parent, tried to terminate the First Student contract last fall, but was outvoted. He's expecting a smoother start this year.
I think that they're out to prove that last year was an anomaly, that they as a company are better than that, and that they're going to be, you know, doing the best that they can to earn our business for next year. I think very clearly we will see in the first few weeks, you know, how that goes. And, you know, coming into September, we're going to know, you know, if they're going to be someone we're looking at for our vendor for next year, or if we're going to be going outside to see how many other people we can get to bid this.
Several factors contributed to last fall's busing problems. Unit 5 was trying to save money in light of shaky state funding for student transportation, leading to a change in school start times and major bus route changes. At the same time, First Student was struggling to recruit and retain drivers. As concerns escalated, First Student and the district itself faced criticism for its poor communication with frustrated parents. The situation improved as the 2016-17 school year went on, and First Student brought in a new local manager, Mark Bull, to oversee operations.
I think we're headed in a better direction. I think there's still a little bit to be gained. I think after the startup this year, we'll kind of tell the tale. If, you know, when startup goes good this year, you know, that will help in that part of it a lot. I can tell you just based on the number of phone calls I got last year from when I started to when I ended, it dropped by, I would say, 90%. So, I mean, obviously people are a little better pleased, but I'm sure still there's a lot of doubt until proven otherwise. And if I was a parent, I'd probably feel the same way. So this startup will tell the tale, in my opinion.
As of Monday, First Student has 146 drivers, including standby drivers, to cover its 127 routes, with another group of 15 to 20 drivers expected to complete training soon. Here's Mark Bull.
The culture here seems to have changed a lot for the better. You know, everyone's a lot friendlier. There, people are excited to come back. I didn't have a lot of attrition. So in that sense, that was my number one priority last year, was just getting the culture changed and getting people wanting to come to work. Secondly is taking a look at the whole operation, setting the priorities based on what the customer, the district needs, and then what the company also requirements meeting. And just keep an eye oversight over everything. I mean, the manager can't do it all, but he can oversee everything to make sure it's get done. I got a great staff in place right now, a lot of experience, and they're all very, very happy right now and like what they're doing. So essentially, as a manager, you just oversee the operation, make sure everything gets done. Not that you do it all, you know, you take care of the customer. That's my primary focus, safety of the kids and taking care of the customer needs.
Unlike fall 2016, there are no major route changes planned for the new school year. Drivers were given 2 extra days to work on their routes, and drivers will be driving those same routes in the mornings as they do in the afternoons. There have been some tweaks. Here is Superintendent Mark Daniel.
So, for instance, we have a particular area on one of our more distance schools that those routes, although similar to last year, we've had to do some adjustments to those routes, first student has. And I'll tell you the response time on that. It may have taken several days to weeks to get that accomplished. They accomplished that roughly in the same day. So that tells me the skeleton of the routing system that they had last spring has been carried over. And for the most part, it's landed on solid ground. I am, I'm optimistic, but with hesitation, because we will not know truly until the buses roll on the 16th. Give us a week to iron out those ups, those startup issues. But after a week, I'm hoping to be fairly settled.
Joe Cleary from the school board says the bus system has improved under Bowles' management. Here's what he had to say about how far the district had come in regaining the trust of parents on busing issues.
But as much as anything, I'm a parent. My students, you know, my kids ride the bus with First Student. They're going to be riding that bus, and I have full confidence that when I put them on the bus, you know, on August 16th to get to school, they will, with hopefully out overcrowding, picked up at the right spot, dropped off at the right spot. And I think that First Student, you know, having Mark Bull in place as our vendor, has proven that he was able to take a bad situation. He came in the tail end and helped First Student get to where they needed to be.
Superintendent Daniel says Unit 5 is trying to strike the right balance between serving its students and families while running its buses efficiently. He says First Student is prepared.
I did meet with one of their corporate officers just last week, and we are very much in their thought process. They want to show the Midwest that First Student can deliver, and Unit 5 is one of those, one of those areas where the spotlight is being shined right now.
That's Unit 5 Superintendent Mark Daniel. Before that was school board member Joe Cleary and Mark Bull from First Student. At tonight's school board meeting, Unit 5's Director of Operations, Joe Edelman, will join Mark Bull from First Student for a presentation on the bus system. I'm Ryan Denham.
Also on tonight's Unit 5 school board agenda, a plan to create a new joint liaison committee with the town of Normal.
Support for GLT comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come on the show, a distant memory and a current battle revived the ERA in Illinois. And now, the line between an epidemic and a national emergency. President Trump's drug commission recently called on him to declare a national emergency to deal with the opioid crisis. An initial report from the commission says the 142 deaths each day from drug overdoses mean the death toll is equal to September 11th every 3 weeks. But yesterday, Trump declined to declare that epidemic an emergency. GLT's Ryan Denham talks with Twin Cities health professionals about this development and how big a problem opioid abuse has become in McLean County.
McLean County Coroner Kathy Davis, we'll start with you. What are opioids and what drugs fall into that category?
So opioids are synthetic or naturally occurring products derived from the poppy plant. So they're used as pain medications. So in the prescribed lower dose, they usually help with euphoria and kind of feel as if they take the pain away, but it's more of a sedating type effect. if used correctly, it gives you kind of like euphoria and you just don't worry about the pain as much.
A national CDC study showed that 25% of all drug overdose deaths were related to heroin in 2015. And that number was just 6% back in 1999. The CDC has even declared this an epidemic. So why have opioids emerged as such a public health threat?
I think one thing is the accidental overprescription. So when opioids first came out as pain medications used by Purdue Pharma in 1996, they were considered, so they came out with OxyContin. They came out as a slow-release pain medication, and that the only patient that could overdose or gain a tolerance was over long-term use. Well, you know, fast forward to 4 years after that, they realized that they were having overdoses on it, that it opioids bind to the breathing receptors of the brain, and they were supposed to be 12-hour acting medications, when actually they weren't 12 hours, they were a little bit shorter, and so then a patient would take one more, and then all of a sudden we have the overdoses. So in 4 years after Purdue Pharma came out with OxyContin, it went from you know, not making any money to $1 billion, but Purdue Pharma, per research and data, they have been sued, and they did say that the medication wasn't as it was supposed to be.
So how prevalent are opioids here in McLean County? How many overdose deaths have we had in the last few years?
So in 2015, we had 19 overdose deaths. In 2016, we had 16, so steady. But right now, we've had 7, and it's just half the year. Hmm. So but it is fentanyl and methadone and oxycodone and morphine. And then the big drugs are starting to come out of the synthetic opioids.
Well, let's bring Joan Hartman into the discussion. Joan is the Vice President of Behavioral Health at Chestnut Health Systems, which provides addiction counseling and treatment services. So Joan, what are the primary interventions that health professionals use to respond to the opioid epidemic?
We use a lot of evidence-based treatments, and those include treatments like motivational interviewing, cognitive behavioral therapy, and those are the basis of all of our interventions that we use. We have various levels of intervention. It could, depending on the person's need, you could go to outpatient treatment, come in up to 9 hours a week in outpatient, or you could come in for detoxification, which is a medical process where you receive medications to help with withdrawal and things like that, or residential treatment, which could be up to 28 days.
So, Joan, what does today's average heroin user look like in Illinois? Is this, how old are they? Is it a man or a woman? Where do they live? Is it a big city, a small town? What is this person?
What we see mostly in Illinois is primarily white men and women in their late 20s, and they're now living outside of urban areas. And so it's moved from where back in the 90s it was mostly inner city, low income individuals, and now it's, you know, moderate, medium income people in their mid to late 20s living in more rural and suburban areas.
So this is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm talking about the opioid epidemic with McLean County Coroner Kathy Davis and Joan Hartman, Vice President of Behavioral Health at Chestnut Health Systems. Yesterday, President Trump declined to declare a national emergency related to opioids, going against the recommendation of his own commission that's chaired by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, that would have allowed the Trump administration to remove some barriers and waive some federal rules, such as one that restricts where Medicaid recipients can receive addiction treatment. Trump seems to favor an abstinence approach to drug use, keeping young people off drugs from the start, combined with harsher sentencing in drug cases. Kathy, what did you think of this idea of potentially declaring this a national emergency and ultimately of President Trump's decision to go in another direction and not to do so?
You know, it's a catch-22. So it could have been declared a national emergency, but, you know, I agree with prevention, not getting people on opioids, not getting them addicted to heroin. So education, I think is, you know, educating the consumer, the patient or the addict, education to the physicians, to the pharmacists, to everyone involved. So yes, not to take drugs, not to get there. Or if you do have to take an opioid for pain from a surgery or a fracture, to start low and go slow. on the medications instead of prescribing a lot. Also, you know, there's different types of therapy that they can use. But by the same token, you have to realize that there's a problem out there. So I don't know what they wanted. I'm not well versed on if they had declared it a national emergency, what were they going to do? What would be the after effect? Would they take, you know, opioids or pain meds out of the equation and where it would be difficult to prescribe? Joan probably sees that some of these patients do need the pain medications, that the health insurance does need to pay for some of them. So it can't be the one extreme or the other. There's got to be a happy medium on how to take care of these patients and then, you know, how to not prescribe it, but also if they're prescribed, how to take care of it. So it can be an end-all be-all.
Joan, what about you? What were your thoughts on the Trump administration's moves on this yesterday?
I didn't see a big benefit in declaring it an epidemic. You know, the CDC talks about an epidemic is usually something that's short-term, and this is not necessarily something that is short term. It's something that we've been dealing with for years, and it's not going to be solved in the next 6 months. And really, the biggest benefit to declaring it, that would be access to funds. Well, that fund only has $57,000 in it. So it's not like they're, you know, at the end of 2016, it only had $57,000 in that fund. So it's not like there's going to be a lot of money they're going to be able to access to address the issue.
So, Joan, what are some things that lawmakers, either in Congress or even here in Illinois, could do to actually make things better?
You know, I really agree with the report and the recommendations to start really enforcing parity, because there are a lot of insurance companies who won't pay for detox services for opioid dependents because it's not life-threatening. And but, you know, if you talk with someone who has an addiction to an opioid, it feels pretty life-threatening when they're going through withdrawal. If you look at the fact that they're going through, if you experienced the flu, multiply that by 10, and that's what withdrawal from an opioid feels like. And so if someone's going through that, they're likely to say, you know what, if I just take another dose of whatever I'm on, the opioid, I'll feel better. They're going to do that rather than go through that uncomfortableness. And so I really think that, you know, enforcing parity, making sure that it gets paid for, we have to stop kind of playing the shell game where we just move money from one pot to another in order to address this. And we also have to fund the Medicaid, because Medicaid has been the biggest, lack of funds has been the biggest barrier to people receiving help. And so Medicaid has increased the ability for people to receive treatment services. And so that's, I think, one of the biggest areas is funding and parity.
So, Kathy, you've researched this issue quite a bit. You've spoken to different groups about it. Is this a problem we can kind of get back ahead of, and what can we do to kind of get back on top of it?
Well, that's a great question. I think it would be if, you know, what we're doing right now with you and Jones here is educating the public on what's going on. I think we can't bury our head in the sand anymore, and we need to let it be known that people are here to help you. It is an addiction, it is an illness, and we want to do life-saving measures to get them off the medications. And if they can't get off, how can they live a happy life on perhaps lesser of the pain meds without going to the harder drugs such as heroin or you know, there's new synthetic opioids out there to try to get people more addicted with the fentanyls, the synthetic fentanyls into the heroin. We want people taken care of is what we want, and I don't want to see any more deaths. And educating that one additional pain med, because they're such strong type medications that they bind to the breathing receptors of the brain, and you stop breathing if you take one, you know, so you get the euphoria, you forget to... You don't remember if you took a pain med or not, and so you take an additional one, and that additional one could kill you. Mm. And that's the scary part of it, mm-hmm. I think.
Well, I certainly don't want to insinuate that an overdose death is the only outcome here to worry about. I mean, the addiction itself is bad enough.
Right.
What does that aftermath look like, though? You've had conversations with these families that have suffered, the worst possible outcome with an accidental overdose. What are those conversations like? What do they see?
Well, and you see some where they have locked up the drugs, from their family members, and someone is counting out the medications for them, and the body just can't handle, they can't handle it anymore, and the breathing receptors, they just stop breathing, and it's devastating. They really thought they were doing the correct right thing, and they were working with their medical provider. And it's just really sad and devastating. And like Joan said, it's across the board. It's wealthy. It's people that don't have money. It's everyone, and it's very devastating. And then the ones that are addicts, I don't think they want to be there. There's many, many stories out there that you hear. Gosh, I don't want to be like this anymore.
I want people to understand that recovery is there for everybody, mm-hmm. and that it doesn't matter. We have to stop looking at this as somebody else's problem. These people are our brothers, our sisters, our kids. They're our neighbors. They're the people that we talk to every day that we don't know are struggling with issues like this. And we have to stop making judgment calls on them, and we have to start reaching out and making sure that they get the help that they need. And that recovery is possible for everybody. Research shows that. Recovery is possible for everybody.
That's Joan Hartman, Vice President of Behavioral Health at Chestnut Health Systems. She's joined today by McLean County Coroner Kathy Davis. I'm Ryan Denham.
You can find a link to the new report issued by the White House's Commission on Combating Drug Addiction and the Opioid Crisis on our website, WGLT.org.
Wait for it. Wait for it. Wait for it. No, seriously, you gotta wait for the Sweet Corn Blues Festival. The corn isn't finished growing yet, but when it's done, be sure and visit your GLT pals at the Sweet Corn Blues Festival, August 26th and 27th. There's live music, fresh sweet corn, and it's all in Uptown Normal. Find more info at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Jack Batal Real Estate Group at Keller Williams. Jack and his team are committed to helping Bloomington Normal continue to thrive by giving back to GLT and other local nonprofits. Current listings at jacksguarantee.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up in a few minutes on Sound Ideas, Super Suckers, and it's not the victim of a con artist. The Kevin Hart Jazz Trio plays at Baxter's American Grill in Bloomington. That's tomorrow evening from 6 to 10 p.m. Look for more arts listings on our community page at WGLT.org. Illinois was a battleground for a fight over the Equal Rights Amendment decades ago. It appears it might once again earn that status. Rachel Otwell reports for Illinois Issues.
Rally cries ringing out from the state capitol lawn and rotunda have changed over the years, but one has resurfaced. That was from 1975. And that's from just a few months ago, during a women's march this spring. The ERA reads, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." It passed Congress and went to the states for ratification while Richard Nixon was in the White House in 1972. Mary Lee Sargent is a longtime activist who lived in Champaign-Urbana for much of her life.
Without ERA, we do not have equal protection under the Constitution.
Sargent founded the grassroots group of second-class citizens, which carried out numerous direct actions to support the ERA. One involved writing the name of an opposing legislator on the Capitol floor in animal blood. Getting that blood involved convincing a slaughterhouse it would be used for a Shakespeare production. Still, there was plenty of theater.
We had a rally, and while the rally was going on, 17 of us chained ourselves together in front of the doors of the Senate.
Not all ERA supporters were as radical, and rallies were held elsewhere in the state. One in 1980 drew tens of thousands of people to Chicago's Grant Park. Overall, the issue had bipartisan and widespread support, coming close to reaching the needed three-fifths supermajority vote from both chambers several times. Enter Phyllis Schlafly. She led a league of proud housewives who passed out fresh-baked bread and pies to lawmakers while arguing against the amendment. Schlafly, who had lost a bid for Congress, went on to start the Eagle Forum, a nonprofit claiming to, quote, lead the pro-family movement. Here she is speaking with NPR host Michelle Martin in 2011.
What that amendment would do is to make all laws sex-neutral. The typical classic law that is not sex neutral is the draft registration law. We were still in the Vietnam War in 1972. I had sons and daughters about age 18. My daughters thought this was the craziest thing they ever heard.
Schlafly was also opposed to abortion and LGBTQ rights. She saw the ERA as a threat to those conservative values. The extended deadline for ratification in 1982 came and went to no avail in Illinois. That hasn't stopped Jean Marie DeRay, who's with the state chapter of ERA Action.
Equal Rights Amendment, it would have provided protections for women at every level of government.
DeRay says those protections include fair pay.
Women are not being valued for the work that they do. They're not even being valued as human beings. And they certainly are not being valued as equal.
But just like in the 70s, not all women are on board. Lori Higgins is with the Illinois Family Institute, which opposes the idea. She argues women,
they are not institutionally deprived of any rights, and this ERA has nothing to do specifically with women.
Higgins says she's worried passage would mean men and women would be forced to share public spaces like locker rooms and bathrooms. State Senator Heather Staines, a Democrat from Chicago, says her most recent legislation for ratification, which passed out of a committee earlier this year, would likely have the votes needed in that chamber. However,
it's the House that didn't have the vote, so we're trying to focus on developing more support in the House for it. To get a supermajority in the House, we're going to have some Republican support.
Nevada voted to ratify the ERA earlier this year. So only two more states are needed to get to the required 38. But since the deadline for ratification passed back in 1982, it's unclear what congressional or legal action could result. I'm Rachel Otwell.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. GLT's news and interview show Sound Ideas is on air and online at WGLT.org. And on August 24th, it's on the road at the Normal Theater in Uptown Normal. You're invited to attend a live edition of Sound Ideas called State Budget Challenges Ahead, produced in cooperation with NPR Illinois. Find out how 2 years without a state budget has affected schools, social service agencies, and other organizations, and hear what may lie ahead. Join the GLT News team and NPR Illinois for a Sound Ideas edition called State Budget Challenges Ahead, live from the Normal Theater at 6 p.m. August 24th. And hear the latest episode of Sound Ideas at WGLT.org. The Governor's Rural Affairs Council in Illinois is trying to tackle rural issues by bringing together groups that might not seem to have a lot in common. IPR's Rich Egger has more.
Council member Christopher Merritt says one example involves the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity. both have representatives on the council, even though Merritt says on the surface it seems the DCEO would focus on urban areas while the Ag Department would deal strictly with rural Illinois.
But it turns out that when those two entities work together, you can think about small farmers selling into urban farmers markets. You can think about value-added agriculture where farmers are thinking about on-farm businesses.
Merritt says another example has the Illinois State Board of Education collaborating with the Illinois Community College Board. They're working on dual credit classes, which Merritt says are important in rural areas. He points out many rural school districts are too small to offer the broad curriculum you might find in urban and suburban school districts.
So maybe figuring out how to do a better job of getting community college credit for high school students is one way that you can help those rural students compete with their urban counterparts.
Merritt says these issues and more are addressed in an annual report the commission submits to the legislature. The group recently met in Macomb to review its latest report. The council is chaired by Lieutenant Governor Evelyn Sanguinetti. It has about two dozen members. Most are appointed from state agencies, but it also has representatives from a couple nonprofit groups, plus a few citizen members. Rich Egger reporting.
Coming up at 7 this evening is GLT's Center Stage. It's music from Broadway and Hollywood each week on Center Stage, 7 to 9 p.m. on 89.1 FM and WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Tomorrow in Sound Ideas, we'll hear about After Hours, a Bloomington-based National Award-winning barbershop quartet. Here's a sample of their music. It's called Gonna Build.
From a little hill, I'm gonna build me a mountain, yeah. At least I hope I will. I'll build a mountain. I'm gonna build it high. I don't know how I'm gonna do it. I only know I'm gonna try. Well, I'm gonna try.
I'm gonna build me a daydream from a little hole. I'm gonna push that daydream
up the mountain slope. Oh yeah, I'll build a daydream. I'm gonna see it through, gonna see it. Yes, I'm gonna build a mountain and a daydream.
Gonna make them all come true. Bum ba doo ba doo.
I'm gonna build me a heaven from a little
hell.
Somehow
I'm gonna
build a heaven and
oh,
wah 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 wah. Build my heaven. Daydream up the mountain, heaven will be waiting there. Doo-wop, doo-wop,
I'm gonna build a rhythm.
Doo-wop, doo-wop,
here I go.
Doo-wop, doo-wop,
doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop, doo-wop. I'm gonna build me a mountain from a little hill.
I'm gonna build me a mountain.
Gonna Build by After Hours, a Bloomington-based National Award-winning barbershop quartet. Hear the interview tomorrow with GLT's Laura Kennedy on Sound Ideas. The Super Suckers return to the Twin Cities to play the Castle Theater tomorrow night when Jeff Wilson of North Street Records in Uptown Normal caught wind of that announcement. Music from one of his favorite bands began blasting the store. It has not stopped, as GLT's John Norton found out when he stopped in this week to hear what's playing on the store's turntable.
So you're not just a big fan of the Super Suckers. You're friends with the Super Suckers.
Yeah, man, they're a friendly band, pretty cool guys. We got to know them over the years just by seeing them so many times, and if you became a member of their fan club, you could get in free to their gigs, so that was always a good thing. But, you know, about 14 years ago, they even came and played our record store at the grand opening, and I couldn't be more proud.
So you became friends before the grand opening.
Yeah, I think that's part of the reason why they did our stores, because they knew us and they knew we were nuts about them.
I see you've got their, what a lot of people say is universally their best album on the turntable right now.
Well, it's all opinion, of course, but of course. I love tons of their records. But yeah, La Mano Cornuda is one of my all-time favorites, I think mostly because the first time I ever saw the Super Suckers, they were on that tour, and that's the first album I ever bought by them. You know, La Mano Cornuda stands for Flying Horn Hands.
So we're listening to the opening track right now. What's the name of this song?
Yeah, the first song on this album is Creepy Jackalope Eye, man, and if you know what a jackalope is, it's a kind of a fictional thing. They got lots of really great songs on this record, man. There's Gold Top and On the Couch, and there's a reason why this album is everybody's favorite, because they were still young and mean. It's just a killer record.
Before we start recording, you were talking about how they were originally from Arizona and moved up to Seattle to be part of that scene up there. But they were never really grunge, but they were never really punk either. They were never really a lot of different things. They seemed to embody all of those things, but were never one of them.
Yeah, you know, they're like any kind of American melting pot band. You know, they're a little bit of everything, but if anything, they're high-octane rock and roll. They take their main inspiration, I think, from like bands like Ramones and Motorhead, and you know, some of those things get lumped into certain categories, but as we all know, critics really don't know what they're talking about most of the time.
So I'm at North Street Records in Uptown Normal. Jeff Wilson is behind the counter playing the Super Suckers album.
Coming to town August 10th at the Castle Theater.
Why don't you take us to another track on this album?
Well, you know, one of the first videos I ever saw was for the Gold Top. And Gold Top is a Les Paul, and it's a favorite guitar of the Super Suckers because it's, you know, the great American rock and roll guitar. So let's play Gold Top.
So you've been a fan for a long, long time, and you said they played the store 14 years ago for the grand opening. What for you makes the Super Sucker so special?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, it's like they're real rock and roll. They don't pretend. You know, it's like they've got a thing. Even when they play live, they don't really have an encore. They just stand there and play a few more songs for you because encores take too much time. You know, so it's the patented Super Suckers fake encore. You know, everything about them is great. Their lyrics, their rock and roll. They're just one of those bands that everybody should know about, but don't.
I remember seeing the Super Suckers somewhere in the mid-90s when they opened for the Toadies and for what was then White Zombie. You hadn't gone to Rob Zombie then. What are some of your favorite shows that recollect?
Well, you know, the first time I ever saw them was in 94, and it was with the New Bomb Turks. And New Bomb Turks are one of those great legendary bands from Ohio, so that was a great double bill. But, you know, the time I saw them at the Double Door with a band called Tenderloin, that was really a great show. And they were super high octane that night. I think they had a lot of friends in the crowd. I'm not sure why that show was so special, but I do know that the drummer played it nude that night. I guess he lost a bet in poker. It was a crazy night.
La Mano Cornuda is the name of the album from the Super Suckers we're listening to from, what, 1994?
Yeah. You know, and the cool thing about the CD, too, is back in the day of CD jukeboxes, if you were in the know, press track 14 and it plays the entire album on one track.
Well, you were saying how they embody so many different sounds, basically American rock and roll, but they did a switch for a while. They ventured into more country music.
Yeah, you know, I heard that Sub Pop wanted to make a new record but didn't quite give them enough money, so they decided to make a country record. And the record's called Must Have Been High. And, man, I think it's one of the best country albums I've ever heard.
Do you have it here in the shop?
We have it here. You know, it's one of those records I can't believe they even made it. You know, it's such a great record. I can't believe a rock and roll band turned out such a true country record. Yeah, let me put this thing on, man. There's a harmonica at the very beginning of it, and I remember a friend's dog would always howl as soon as we played this album. But this was one of our favorites for a long time. We played it every day.
So dogs all over the Twin Cities are howling as we speak right now.
They love the Super Suckers, too.
I kind of bum around and I wonder what I'm feeling like and what I do. I take a look around.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton at North Street Records in Uptown Normal. We're listening to the Super Suckers getting ready for the show at the Castle Theater. How about another song or two from La Mano Cornuda?
Yeah, well, let's play the one called How to Maximize Your Kill Count. You know, they write songs about serious subjects, too, and this one's about, you know, shootings in school and things like that. But, of course, it's tongue-in-cheek for the Super Suckers.
So the Super Suckers have been around for a number of decades now. Did you think they would last this long?
No, I thought that after their 20th anniversary tour, I thought they were going to call it done. But
is there anything different about the band now than, say, 25 years ago?
Well, you know, they've had a few lineup changes and things like that, but now they still sound great. You can't beat it, man. If you want to go see a really true, great American rock and roll band, this is the band to go see.
The music of the Super Suckers from their album La Mano Cornuda. Our thanks to Jeff Wilson of North Street Records and Uptown Normal for sharing with John Norton the music playing on the store's turntable. The Super Suckers play the Castle Theater tomorrow night. This is WGLT Normal and WGLT.org. Thanks to John Norton and Ryan Denham for today's show. Let us know what you think of the show at news@WGLT.org. This is GLT, Bloomington Normal's public media.